So, is this the end of ISKCON? I hope not. At the end of the day, for me, it's first of all, what's ISKCON, right? And what's not ISKCON and what's taking place. So, on a personal level, I'm not a member of ISKCON institutionally. And therefore, some people may think I don't have much to offer, or I don't have the same degree of right to express myself about certain current issues in the ISKCON community, because I am an outsider to the institution. Though to begin with, I may argue that the view of an outsider is many times very precious and very important, not necessarily mine, but outsiders' view generally offer a very unique perspective, especially when we have become, in some cases, too much of an insider. As one of my teachers will say, it's very healthy to inhabit the edge of the inside. So we are in dialogue with what's going on outside of the circle, and we are not so much insulated. So some may think I'm an outsider, but at the same time, I consider myself a member of ISKCON, though I'm not a member of ISKCON, a card-carrying institutional member of it. But I am a member of ISKCON if we define ISKCON as I choose to do. As proud but smelt at heart. ISKCON for me, of course, there is an institutional dimension to it. There are structures and rules and names and buildings and papers, but there is a substance and essence and a melted heart, Prabhupada's melted heart, through which ISKCON became a reality. So with that ISKCON, I fully identify and I personally feel I fully belong to. There is the institutional side to it, but the substantial part, the substantial phase is to what I feel I belong, and I can only belong. And that's for me the house in which the whole world can live, as it was ascribed to Prabhupada. He built a house in which the whole world can live. So that ISKCON, yeah, I belong to it. And for me, it's very important to make the difference always between belonging and fitting in. This whole conversation, this whole issue here for me, in many ways, is about belonging versus fitting in. All that invites for one thing and all that needs to take place for the other to be there, real belonging. As I like to personally say, we can never belong to an institution. Really belong to an institution. We can only belong to a heart, to another person, to a heart that beats in such a way that makes my own heart beats, and I naturally choose. I'm irresistibly drawn to feel I belong there. And if that heart happens to be affiliated with that institution, I may end up being affiliated with that institution only because that beating heart was there to begin with. A heart beating uniquely. And that's what I personally experience in connection to someone like Srila Prabhupada. Again, his own melted, sweetly melted beating heart, his life and message and of course, many of the beautiful souls that love Prabhupada, that serve Prabhupada, and with whom I had the great fortune of being friends with, being connected with, whether we are speaking about many Prabhupada disciples, many disciples of those of his disciples, or many well-wishers from various Gaudiya Vaishnava affiliations and even beyond the Gaudiya Vaishnava community. So it is from this place of affection, of belonging, and of loving concern, to be honest, that I am sharing the following words, not attacking ISKCON in any way, not pointing to any specific members, any specific group or community without the broader ISKCON community, but just trying to analyze, hopefully in an unbiased way, as a well-wisher, participant in an essential place in ISKCON. Analyze the current situation with as much, hopefully, nuance and honesty as possible. So, in my personal case, as many of you know, I'm not currently connected to any institution. I'm related essentially to Tathagata Sangha, but I do not consider that as institution, just as the name to the tribe of like-minded spirits that we happen to get together. So, and even while I was mostly connected to an institution in my past years as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, I've never considered myself an institutional person. quite the contrary. I'm coming from teenage years of the punk rock scene and lots of rebelliousness against institutions and stuff like that. But no time to go there in detail now. But so I'm coming from that place. At present, I have no plans of joining ISKCON as an institution. I have no plans of joining any institution. But also at the same time, I have nothing against ISKCON as an institution, and I have nothing against any institution. Indeed, I acknowledge the role of institutions. Many of us wouldn't be here without certain institutions facilitating the extension of a message and an experience that we had, and we happen to be here now in the Gaudiya Vaishnava community. So I then have nothing against the role of institution, acknowledging the role, the necessity, as long as they don't fall into institutionalism, right? Institutions for the sake of institutions, replacing the people that make the institutions. So in that context also, I think we need to acknowledge how human flaws, because again, humans made up institutions, human flaws filter, will always filter in any institution. We all will be part of the institutional experience. And ISKCON and the current issues and dynamics it's facing is not an exception to that rule. And also it's not the only case, again. So yeah, sometimes human messiness, or even natural cycles in nature and in life, invite for periods of crisis, periods of ups and downs, periods of winters and autumns and springs and summer, which is another way of saying periods of creation, maintenance, and necessary dissolution. So whenever that's actually unavoidable and necessary, as honoring a cycle of nature and life, all of us should be willing to, not only to honor that, to allow that to happen, but even to participate in that, to facilitate that, trusting the natural order of things, and trusting that things continue to evolve and unfold. Of course, I'm not saying that in any fatalistic way and saying this is the case now. Of course, whenever we can do something about in trying to keep something, preserve something, not allow something to be destroyed that could actually be preserved, we are invited to equally engage with that. That's an important, equally important call. So through this sharing and presentation today, I'm not trying to give any final conclusive verdict, but hopefully just share some food for thought in this ongoing conversation that may allow each one to continue being part of this ongoing conversation and ongoing contemplation. And on this issue, like with any issue, it has its own layers of nuance and complexity, and it's never as simplistic as we may try to make it in many cases. So I'll try to contribute my 2 cents, no more than 2 cents, to this communal dialogue and conversation. I think it's very healing and important that we engage in ongoing dialogue. Especially from the side of trying to put emphasis and attention on the multi-layered nature of this issue. While of course the main topic here for some may seem to be female Diksha Gurus in ISKCON, are they allowed or not? I personally feel that there are many other topics in the background of this topic, which happens to be at the foreground. So we need to put both in the picture, foreground and background, especially in times we are living where foreground news, foreground events, issues generally dominates our lives. Foreground dominates our lives, and many times it's overestimated. And by that being the case, it hides the greater context from which that foreground has emerged, which is the background. You cannot have a foreground without a background, a backdrop. So my attempt here is also bringing the background to the foreground. So we keep all the situations in place and we can properly identify what's the actual problem or the actual problems with their multi-layered nature. Because sometimes misidentifying the problem is in itself the greatest problem, because then you try to solve a false problem basically. I always remember Albert Einstein saying, if I have to solve a problem, I have 1 hour to solve a problem, I will spend 55 minutes trying to understand what's the actual problem, and then 5 minutes solving it. In other words, it's so important first to have the problem right, and then the solution will come by itself very naturally. But many times, the solution never happens to come because we have misidentified the problem, whether by pointing to something else, whether by being too simplistic. So again, it's very important first to ascertain which is the actual problem or problems before attempting to solving them. Again, what to speak of not being willing to acknowledge that there is a problem at all and trying to just become harmony junkies and la la la. Or again, being too simplistic in trying to reduce everything to what's the one single problem, and therefore what's the one single solution to that problem. But again, in my opinion, what we are dealing here with, and not only here, but with any single thing that we dare to call a problem, is not a problem, one problem, but a multi-layered polycrisis, what I will call. And again, crisis is not a bad word. Remember, the very meaning of the word crisis, vantage point, or not vantage point, sorry, turning point, decisive point. A situation where we're invited to take certain choices that will, of course, dramatically affect the future unfolding of things. But that's how life operates, right? So that's for me an important emphasis that I will try to make in today's presentation. The multi-layered nature of this polycrisis, poly-turning point invitation. But of course, before going there, okay, the main topic in the foreground is female Diksha gurus. Is there a place for that in ISKCON? Of course, this is mostly an ISKCON-related discussion. And I briefly touched upon that 2 weeks ago in one weekly. I conducted Saturday Q&As, and someone brought the topic because, again, it's a topic of discussion in the community at large. So brief words coming from that I want to share here. Of course, for me, the question, can women be Diksha gurus, in one sense, is the wrong question. Again, in terms of identifying the problem, identifying the issue, identifying the question. For me, the fact that this is such a big issue points to bigger issues. For me, the fact, the discussion of a woman being Diksha gurus is just the tip of an iceberg of further questions that should be asked, or further even misconceptions about Guru Tattva. If we are talking, just limiting the discussion to Guru Tattva, misconceptions about it, just the fact that this is such a topic of discussion and we are not sure if this is a case or not in some cases, points that there are so many more misconceptions below that. The gender debate, again, is merely the tip of a much larger iceberg concerning maybe how authority, qualification, tradition are understood. But of course, in brief, and some of you will agree with me and some of you will totally disagree with my whole presentation, and it's fine. We will have to be willing to agree to disagree and even love each other while disagreeing. But guruhood or guruness, gurutva, has nothing to do with being woman, being man, gender, caste, nationality, bodily identity, kiva vipra kiva nyasa sudra kene hai, say Krishna tattva vetai guru hai, Mahaprabhu will say. It doesn't matter this position, that situation. If you are a knower of the truth of Krishna, you are a guru. In all the main verses in scripture that define guru, whether it's in the Bhagavatam, tashmat gurum prapadyata, whether it's in the Bhagavad Gita, tadbiti pranipatena, whether it's in the Upanishad, tadbigyanartam sa guru me bhavihigachet, all these main verses basically say the same from different perspectives. First, given the qualities, attributes of a disciple, and then the attributes of the guru. And all them agree that a guru is to be, how to say it, decided upon inner realization, scriptural knowledge, and inner realization of that knowledge, control mind and senses, balance humanity, if you will, and not by external attributes like where you are born, are you male, female. Again, any of these foundational verses are describing guru and disciple list maleness, as a prerequisite, so to say. And even if we can bring some obscure relative statements in certain books, those exist in certain particular contexts, and I won't say they are never to be over-absolutized to the point of, diluting these main statements we all know about guru. So for me, asking whether a woman can be a guru is like, as I said the other day in this conversation, it's like asking whether someone that is not too tall can be a father, or a woman who is blonde can be a mother, or a teacher that was born in Argentina and not in Denmark can be a geography teacher. And again, most of you will say that's absurd, that's the wrong question. In order to define who can be a mother or a teacher or whatever, the qualities, the qualification is beyond these considerations. But it's very interesting how we are placing this emphasis in this particular regard. So again, obsessing over gender obscures, of course, more essential questions, which are the actual qualifications of a guru, because it's not a cheap issue. It's not that only because you are a woman, also you are qualified to be a guru, just not to take it to the other level in a toxic feminist, extremely feminist way, so to say. Women have to be guru. If you're a woman, be a guru. No, it's about qualification, right? So what's the nature of spiritual authority, which is the actual qualification to be a guru? How do realization, spiritual transmission actually function? So for me, even if the gender issue is resolved, let's put it that way, even if in some particular meeting committee day, ISKCON decides, okay, women from now on can be gurus, okay, but still, that's not the solution to the whole issue. Again, that for me is the tip of the iceberg, and further deeper misconception may need to be addressed. That I'm not saying exists in the minds and hearts of every single member of ISKCON, but in my opinion, it's my opinion here, on the official institutional stance toward guru, there are a few things that in my opinion are not correct. And of course, again, in connection to the discussion claims, like I've heard things like, okay, Jahnava Mata was a guru, she can be a guru, but a woman can only be guru. Okay, let's make an exception. You can be a guru if you're a woman, only if you are of the stature of Jahnava Mata, while men do not have to reach that level of status and still can be guru. Again, this is theologically incoherent. This is a distortion, in my opinion, on guru tattva. This is a form of apasiddhanta. If you have apasiddhanta, you have apasampradaya as a result of that. At least you have an apasampradayic expression of a genuine sampradaya. And many times it's all connected to aparad. All these apas are connected, right? Things that go against the natural flow of things. So again, this is not about only whether women can be gurus or not, but at a deeper level, and here comes for me the main point of my presentation, it's about many other things, but still staying for a minute with the woman issue, so to say. For me, at a deeper level, the fact that we have a difficulty with the situation of women being Diksha gurus or not is about a deeper issue with how we relate to women, how we treat women, how we give them proper honor, place, respect, how we are willing to learn from them, how we truly honor the principle, the female principle, the divine feminine, as an essential dimension of reality, not only in biologically born females, but even in us as males. Now, I mean, I'm born a male biologically, but I have my female side. So I have to honor and work on that and integrate that. So many times, the canceling of woman in many ways is a way of, it's an external symptom of how unable we have been in integrating our own female side. So again, when in spirituality, and of course that implies an over identification with the male side, which ends up in toxicity. Any of the two sides of the yin-yang, so to say, any of the two sides of the polarity would over-emphasize, become toxic. So when spirituality becomes overtly identified with the male side, patriarchal side, with lots of order, lots of rigidity, structure, control, rules, again, it reflects a one-sided, overtly masculine, in this case, way of understanding authority, which may end up being authoritarian. And we end up resembling more a dictatorship or a totalitarian regime rather than a free flow, fascinating faith journey based on wonder and awe and voluntary surrender out of the heart, right? So for me, the feminine principle is so crucial, and many times we are afraid of it because of all that the feminine principle invites us to. Feminine principle, the feminine side, invites us to equally to things that are equally sacred and necessary. I have nothing against the male principle, but feminine principle is all about creativity, sensitivity, relationality, relational wisdom, receptivity, beauty, awe and wonder, and even the capacity to give life to what is new. So newness. And newness is tied to the idea of chaos many times, because creativity happens out of chaos, out of something that bringing order out of chaos, bringing new life out of the unknown. And most of us are terrified with that. So no wonder, historically, not only in this particular issue, we have tried to repress the feminine. But when this dimension is mistrusted, when this dimension is marginalized, traditions tend to harden, tend to lose their vitality, tend to become basically irrelevant, a museum piece, frozen in time, frozen in history. And it's paradoxical, because as Gaudiya Vaishnavas in particular, our ultimate idea is adoring the goddess, right? It's all about Radha. Krishna as Mahaprabhu tasting her heart. It's all revolving around the feminine principle of bhakti, soul seen as prakriti, female natured. And it's interesting because throughout history, many religious traditions have emphasized the worship of a goddess. And as one of my teachers say, probably as an unconscious way of acknowledging their neglect of the divine feminine in their lives. So they speak about worshiping the goddess, but in practice, they are not dealing in a healthy way with the feminine principle. So for me, this is deeply tied to all this that in the more external form looks like female Diksha Gurus. No, honoring and integrating properly all that the divine feminine invites us to. And still, this is the tip of an iceberg in many ways. Again, not only in terms of further misconceptions about Guru Tattva, in my opinion, but also to other sociological, psychological, anthropological considerations. As I say, the poly crisis. I'd like to bring that word for a moment back. Because again, here, in my opinion, we are not dealing with one single problem that only requires one single solution. We invoke it, we move forward, life's fine. It's a poly crisis. What's a poly crisis? Poly crisis is defined as a complex problem constituted by a nexus of reciprocally entwined crises. In itself, the definition is complex, right? So a poly crisis is more than one crisis, a multi-layered crisis, which generally includes complex feedback loops between one crisis and the other, blurred boundaries between them, cascade effects, mutual amplification of this nested crisis. And again, I don't want to sound tragic, it's just how life, what life is many times. Goes beyond these particular situations, right? Hopefully all this is a way of normalizing these situations as cycles in life and being willing to acknowledge and embrace and confront and integrate them as part of our growth and maturity as individuals and as a collective. So yeah, I personally think that in connection to this guru issue, so to say, there are considerable layers of crisis, layers of misunderstanding. Again, in the official institutional stance of ISKCON, not necessarily in every individual member of it. But again, many of these misunderstandings, to be fair, because I don't want to sound like I'm stigmatizing or criticizing or pointing, many of them come in one sense from very understandable places. Very humanly genuine places. Like I can understand, for example, when Srila Prabhupada left this world and there were some gurus in ISKCON at the time, there was so much confusion and problems at that time with many of them. Again, life happens, I can understand how that happened. I can understand how, which was their reaction to those understandable problems as well. Like many times was, like today's happened in my opinion, like an overemphasizing of Srila Prabhupada to the point in some case of what I will call pseudo-rhythmicism in ISKCON. And again, I'm not stigmatizing that. I can totally understand from which place it's coming. Of course, not only pseudo-rhythmicism, then we have rhythmicism as a result, extended branch of that in outside of the ISKCON community, which in general for me it's more like a trauma response. And again, I'm not saying that criticizing. I'm just saying I can understand personally with my own life experience in connection to gurus, I can understand how after going through a few complex traumatic experiences, you may want to bring some order and some certainty and some stability in the midst of chaos and disorder and faith crisis. And let's stick to Prabhupada. Let's stick to someone who can give us security and reassurance. I totally understand that. I totally empathize with that. Though I may not agree that's Siddhantically accurate. But I acknowledge it. I understand it. At the same time, I acknowledge it as a misreading of the ultimate guru tattva Siddhanta. And of course, that sometimes have taken the overemphasizing of one single figure takes to the underemphasizing of anyone else, and many times even lack of appreciation or acknowledging of other Vaishnavas outside of ISKCON, other even God brothers of Prabhupada at the time, other Gaudiya lineages that coexist in the same family tree, so to say. In my personal case, I'm very deeply connected with Srila Bhakti Rakshaksidhar Dev Goswami Maharaj, as Srila Prabhupada himself was. And I personally consider there's not much acknowledgement of that, who he is, which is his place in relation to Prabhupada in connection to ISKCON. And besides this, because I'm not here promoting Srila Siddhar Maharaj, but I can understand how there is a fear of whatever is different from how Prabhupada did things, what he said, and from here we have the typical Prabhupada said, but he said so many things, of course. But all that comes from a place of a tender faith that wants to continue growing, and many times in a situation of crisis and survival mechanism take certain stances that at certain time in the past were totally necessary and understandable, but if in time they become the official stance or teaching, that starts to become probably in many cases a deviation and a problem. So this is part of the actual iceberg, this part of the layers of the poly crisis. And of course, there are many other layers to this poly crisis. There is politics, there is influence, position, fame, money, ulterior motives and agenda. Let's be honest, we are not in Golok Vrindavan yet, guys. But again, while saying all this, hopefully I personally choose to see all of this not so much as demonic tendencies and evil people wanting to destroy Prabhupada's movement and we have to destroy them, but mostly as a human frailties of still conditioned souls, of course, who do not have a strong sense of, many times, of identity. So I don't have enough self-acceptance, self-esteem, so I need to define myself in terms of position, certainty. I need to be powerful, I need to have a name, I need to have followers, because if I don't have any of that, who am I? And of course, who is free from that? Again, normalizing these situations, though at the same time trying to work on them. An example of that I always like to invoke is the word pratishtha, that many times is labeled as the worst possible thing and the most subtle anartha. But pratishtha in one sense means pratishtha, to one's sta, to one's certainty of fixity, prati, at every moment, at every step. Like too much certainty, to want an overdose of certainty. Why? Because I'm afraid of dealing with the unknown. I'm afraid of entering liminal space. So if we analyze this pratishtha, it's not so much an evil, demonic, soul, bad person, but a very frail, insecure human being, trembling. So all that hopefully invites us to address all these situations with understanding and compassion for each other and for ourselves, who may be also falling to these frailties in one degree or another. Of course, another layer of this whole poly crisis is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur will call cultural baggage. Each one of us come to a spiritual movement which presents absolute ideals, but most of us bring our own cultural baggage and filter the absolute reality with some more relative cultural sensitivities. And this, I wouldn't say this is not an exception to the rule. Some smarter sensitivities playing itself out here, being born in India, being born male, being a Brahmin, and the threat thing, which again is from the essential Gaudiya Vaishnava perspective, all these considerations are utterly relevant, utterly irrelevant, and not very important. Mm-hmm. But when we put relative considerations above the absolute ones, when we take details and make them principles, that's when we have a problem. Mm-hmm. So again, I can acknowledge there is tension, there is resistance in this particular issue. And many of these emerge, as I say, from many cases, some cases unintegrated trauma, in some cases from genuine confusion, in some cases from structural incentives, ulterior motives, power preservation, defense mechanisms, genuine fear, but unacknowledged. And often all of these things many times coexist in the same person or more than one of those. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not just one single thing. And therefore, there's no need, again, to stigmatize, as I like to say, what we should be normalizing. Many times, especially in religious movements, we are expert at stigmatizing what we should learn to normalize, to see with compassion and understanding as part of the journey of human beings trying to pursue spirituality and high ideals, acknowledging that, normalizing that, understanding how that plays out in certain collective dynamics, and then addressing those things from that particular place. Another interesting sociological phenomenon, in my opinion, that I've shared with many in the past as well, is that something that I've thought for some time is that most of Prabhupada's disciples, if not all, almost all, met with Prabhupada when Prabhupada was in this world. They were in their teens, and Prabhupada, his age, was basically was kind of his grandfather or grand-grandfather in some cases. So most of Prabhupada's disciples never experienced Srila Prabhupada's living presence, so to say, as adults themselves. Mm-hmm. Therefore, at least in some cases, I'm not absolutizing here, I'm not saying all of them, but I feel that in some cases, in according to my personal experience, what I witness is that many Prabhupada disciples have remained stuck in that particular version of Prabhupada, who Prabhupada was for them as teens, and therefore have a very overtly romanticized idea, and therefore in one sense infantilized idea of Prabhupada. And by saying that, I'm not de-absolutizing or downplaying Prabhupada. I'm just saying we can have an infantilizing an over-romanticized idea of anything and anyone. Mm-hmm. So from there, if we stay with that version of Prabhupada and that version of ourselves in connection to Prabhupada, we may be in the future as we grow as adults, still in some part of us internally, we remain as boys, as children. And we may be afraid of going beyond that, beyond our understanding of Prabhupada as we had it at that time. We may be afraid of betraying Prabhupada by daring to see him with new eyes, discovering a new version of him, discovering a new version of ourselves in connection to him. And again, for me, here comes again the misunderstanding of fully equating Prabhupada with ISKCON and fully equating ISKCON with an institution, a fully equating institution with the GBC, and eventually over-absolutizing whatever is mentioned by a particular group of, I don't doubt, sincere individuals, hopefully, like on an over-absolutized way, like if that was direct proper revelation. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this whole dynamics will break, going back for a moment to the female Diksha Guru issue. This makes some Vaishnavis in ISKCON that I know have people who would like to have them as their gurus, or some of them even may have given initiation in a more type of secret clandestine way, in the black market, so to say. And I know that many of them have not dared even to do that in any way. And they're afraid of giving initiation, because if I give initiation, maybe the GBC will chastise me, will ban me, I may be even kicked out of ISKCON, and that may be equal with leaving Prabhupada, because if I'm kicked out from ISKCON, I'm leaving Prabhupada, I'm betraying him, I'm outside of the circle of mercy of my Gurudev, and so on and so forth. Which again, it all comes from a genuine concern from a good heart. But in my personal opinion, that's a misunderstanding and a kind of childish, immature understanding of who is Prabhupada and what is ISKCON and how spiritual transmission actually takes place beyond forms. Because if we just subscribe to that, if we don't dare to give a voice to the things, to act according to it, we just choose to participate in a regime of fear, which is still choose to be part to belong, quote unquote, though I will say that's fitting in, not belonging. But all this creates a regime of fear, of intimidation, which in my opinion is exactly the opposite of what Prabhupada wanted and what Prabhupada established for ISKCON as its main guidelines. As you may know, I think it was Achyutananda Prabhu Swami at the time, I think, when the official legal ISKCON was established in the 60s. And so many rules, rule number 1.2, 1.3, had to be written for legal institution and documents to be there. But to summarize, let's say, well, at the end of the day, ISKCON has to be ruled by trust and loving affection. And if at any point that stops being the case, all the effort we have put into creating this, we have put into dissolving it, because it has betrayed its original purpose. Again, by this I'm not saying we should do that now, but I'm saying just the ethic for ISKCON, and not only ISKCON, but any relationship, I will say, is hopefully love and trust. So if fear and intimidation and calculation and manipulation becomes the norm, well, we are somewhere else, and something needs to be done, whatever that may be, and every individual may have their own way or their own inspiration in their heart by Krishna in order what to do in relationship to that. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, some of these things will be, as I say before, maybe apasiddhantic, apasampradayic. And again, an apasampradaya, I'm not saying ISKCON is an apasampradaya, I'm saying every single religious movement, bona fide movement, can be misrepresented. So any genuine sampradaya can be misrepresented in an apasampradayic way. So again, ISKCON is Prabhupada's melted heart, is something absolutely pure, beautiful, sublime. But it can be misrepresented in apasampradayic ways, in the name of ISKCON or in the name of any other institution. Again, it's not here taking against an ISKCON. And of course, something else that Prabhupada said, that main deviations, if we want to use that word, though I know it's a strong one, and main opposition and threats to those who denounce the deviations that happen in any religious group, many times come not from outside the tradition, but from its very inside. Mm-hmm. And that's why Prabhupada also spoke about time, how the movement, if this movement cannot be destroyed from the outside, if it's destroyed, will be only destroyed from the inside. Mm-hmm. In other words, we are our own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And I know using words like destruction feel heavy, can feel fearful. Nobody wants to see something beautiful destroyed. But many times what's destroyed or what needs to be destroyed is just a particular outdated version of it, or particular packaging of it, or a particular external structure of it. And that's what, when I think it's important to understand the essence of ISKCON in this case, is something eternal, something that goes beyond an institution. It's something that has to do with Prabhupada's heart, with Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta's heart, today is his appearance day, and with the Parampara's heart, going all the way back to the Sweet Absolute Bhagavan himself. So this is eternal. This cannot be destructed. But we need to develop that dynamic vision to appreciate that wherever it manifests. So again, going back to the main question, is this the end of ISKCON? Does ISKCON need to fully collapse in order to be reborn in a new form? Some may say yes, some may say no, some may say maybe. I don't know. But my point is that what we have seen across history is that sooner or later, this is the case for basically any religious movement. Now, not that it will die completely, but it needs to die to a certain form, to a certain version of it. And we need to die ourselves to our own version in connection to that version. Again, the essence remains divine, untouched, But the externals, many times the buildings, the brands, the names, the structures, they need to die in order to be born again. Again, death is never the final word. Death is just a bridge to resurrection, if we want to use that word. These are the cycles in nature. We can see it all around. In order for it to be a new life, there has to be a corresponding death to that. If you want amrita, immortality, the word amrita includes mrita, which means death. We have to die before we die, as the mystics say, right? Die to live. As Hegel would say, and Srila Siddharmaraj will quote, Bhaktivinoda Thakur will sing, a Vaishnava only dies to live. And death happens many times per day, many times in a lifetime. So we live, we awaken, we are born to the ultimate reality. So sometimes what must happen, again, it's not just decline and renewal, but literally death and resurrection. Whatever needs to take place, hopefully may we allow that to take place. If something needs to die in order to be reborn, we should respect that rhythm. We should honor that, and hopefully we should participate in that. Because I know that the death of ISKCON, if you will, or the death of an institution, or the death of a particular version of anything, is tied, deeply tied to a death of an identity of us, a version of us in connection to that thing that it needs to die. So it feels like dying. It's not an easy one. That's why we don't want to release that, because we may be attached. We are deriving identity from that. But at the same time, there are times in life that it's very clear that we are ready for a new identity, for a deeper version of ourselves. And we need to allow certain things to die, certain versions of ourselves, so we can all be reborn on a new level. Mm-hmm. So this may be institutional failure, if you want to call it that way, the collapse of some external forces. But institutional failure does not equate spiritual failure. Mm-hmm. No, institutional failure doesn't mean that Krishna has abandoned the movement. No, institutional failure doesn't mean that Prabhupada's mission has failed. Institutional failure in this case doesn't mean that bhakti has been compromised in its essence ontologically. And again, I'm talking about ISKCON here, but I could be talking about my own journey with other missions and institutions that I've seen fully collapse literally. So I'm not here pointing to something in particular. So institutional failure, again, doesn't mean spiritual failure. It basically points to human frailties, human insecurities, many times human immaturity, necessary cycles of nature. And we should all be included in all of this. None of us stand outside conditioning, outside history, outside blind spots, outside potential bypassing, or outside the necessarily embrace of cycles of dying to certain version of who we think we are, so we can actually be who we are destined to be. Because if we do not allow this cycle to happen inside of us, that will be reflected in our resistance to allow it to happen on the outside, in an institution, in a relationship with someone else. No? If we are not familiar already with these dynamics on the inside, in our own inner journey, again, this will get reflected in how much capacity we have to release certain versions and ideas, in this case of what ISKCON is, or for that matter, who we are, who Krishna is, what everything is. That's an invitation to grow and to mature and to embrace the possibility of something new, of newness in life. Again, going back to the feminine principle, it's all about giving birth to something new, newness, not being terrified about what's new, what's unknown, and releasing the old so we can take the new step to the new. So we may have many fixed ideas, but again, toxically male-oriented ideas. What's ISKCON? Who is Prabhupada? What's bhakti? Who am I? What's this? What's that? But those are our ideas. Our ideas do not equal reality. My ideas about Krishna are not the same as who Krishna is. My ideas about Prabhupada is not the same as who actually Prabhupada is, in all that he can be. My ideas about myself are not equal to who I'm actually am and all that I can be in potential. So we have to be open to this cycle of nature, to naturalize, normalize this. As one of my mentors will put it, these cycles of nature could be framed as order, disorder, and reorder. So first we have an order, we have in this case an institution, a name, building, things working nice, then some disorder comes, some holy disruption. Because the order started to become status quo, started to become something stagnant, static, not dynamic, something suffocating. So the order is no longer serving its purpose, it needs to be disrupted. So disruption comes. It's felt as a problem, it's felt as a crisis, it's felt as something that shouldn't be happening, that we don't want it to happen, but it's necessary. And when we embrace that, we allow us to go through that, the eye of the storm, the disorder actually brings the whole thing to reorder, to a new level of order, more encompassing, more broad, more deep. And eventually that new order becomes the established order again, the status quo, and that needs to be disrupted again. And then we get to a new order, and so on and so forth. And that's the way how reality expands and evolves. So I like to show how the template is so clearly present in our tradition, in the highest, in the zenith of our tradition, in the Rasa Lila, in the Rasa Dance of Krishna. Krishna is, there's order, disorder, reorder, ongoing. You know, gopis are in their house, working, cleaning, everything is order. Krishna plays the flute. Disorder. The gopis run after the flute, meet Krishna, reorder. They are with him on a new level. But then Krishna sends the gopis back home. Disorder, confusion. But then the gopis argue with Krishna and they convince him to stay and they start to dance and celebrate. Reorder. But then eventually after dancing, some of the gopis feel pride and with Krishna some type of complacency and certainty. Disorder. Krishna disappears. Then he goes with one gopi. That one gopi is with Krishna, reordered. But then Krishna leaves that gopi, another layer of disorder. Then the gopis meet, separation of Krishna. Krishna reappears, reorder. So again, over and over again, that's how life operates. That's how reality unfolds. Besides this particular topic. So I think we all need to speak about the things with honesty, courageously, and willing to pay whatever price needs to be paid for being willing to speak about the truth, hopefully with compassion, with understanding, but also with courage. And I chose to share this video today because also I've been thinking about this for many days, but I knew, okay, today is the appearance of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada. So this is my birthday gift at his feet today. In honor to him, because why? It's an attempt to honor his personality, his fearless spirit in denouncing what needed to be denounced and speaking what needed to be spoken. Speak truth to power, so to say, to the current structures of powers of the time. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, people want to kill him. And many of those people were Vaishnavas or Hindus, not necessarily Muslims, other people. No? And again, he was very strong and very strict with himself. And by himself, I mean, in this case, also strict with his own tradition. So trying to pay attention to all the potential deviation that were happening at home, because it's very easy to blaspheme and downplay the problems and highlight the problems of other religions. But to look at home and point that, that's Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. That's his definition of humility, as I quote in my book, Radical Personalism. He will say, humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. That means to be humble. Humility is not diminishing yourself, disempowering yourself, humiliating yourself in a toxic way, allowing yourself to be abused. It's to be perfectly submissive to the truth. And that has a price. And having no sympathy for untruth, especially when it's presented in the name of truth. And all that has a price. And again, we should be willing to pay the price. The price for living the truth and embracing the truth sometimes is being persecuted, being even killed by your own, generally. But there's a higher price to pay, which is when you betray yourself and when we do not embrace the truth. Satyam Param Dimahi. That's the clarion call of our tradition. Let's deeply meditate on the supreme truth, which entails let's live a life aligned with truth. And when recording this today, in my Facebook memory showed up a beautiful quote also that I want to share with you just to conclude. From Brian McLaren, he's a Christian author, friend of mine. He wrote a very beautiful book, Do I Stray Christian? That was a big, big inspiration from my second book, Radical Personalism. Do I Stay a Gaudiya? which are the reasons to leave the tradition and to remain as such. Of course, here I am still as a Gaudia, and I'm not planning to leave. But there are many reasons that we have to bring into our mind what makes people leave the tradition, what makes people stay in the tradition for the wrong reasons, and how to deal when certain things need to collapse and allow that to happen. So I'd like to share this quote with you that I met today and I shared in my Facebook as well. It says, "Failure and success may look like binary opposites, but put them into motion and they can actually be more like what winter and spring, like mass extinction and events and post-event evolutionary explosions of diversity. Together, they push the process of growth forward. If you want evolution, you have to accept struggle and mass extinction events. If you want birth, you have to go through labor that feels like it's killing you. If you want a new genesis of diversity and beauty, you have to accept that things must look absolutely hopeless first. You have to commit to do the right thing against all odds. Otherwise, the systems maintain their equilibrium and the status quo spins on." Again, and too much status quo becomes too rigid, too much order, suffocating, then you have a totalitarian regime, a cult, a dictatorship. So, to bring this to a close, what I've tried to do here is not to solve, so to say, ISKCON, nor to weaponize a controversy, no, but to name what many of us can already feel, that this is not a single issue debate like any other debate. It is a multi-layered polycrisis or a multi-layered opportunity of turning points. A crisis is a turning point. A nexus of reciprocally entwined tensions, again, doctrinal, institutional, human, cultural, psychological, historical. And again, this is not the case with this particular issue, but that's how life as a whole operates. Order, disorder, reorder, the cycle of nature. And again, the problem is not only one, so the solution is not only one either. Simplicity is not the same as being simplistic, right? So we want to be simple, but simplicity entails integration of complexity. And being simplistic entails being evasive of the integration of complexity that we are being called to. And yes, of course, the question of woman initiating is real, but again, it's just a symptom also, often the tip of an iceberg that reaches into how we understand guru tattva, authority, belonging, fear, participation, the difference between the institution and Prabhupada's melted heart, essence and formality, principles and details. And again, if we keep staring only at the foreground, what we have in your face, we may keep missing the background, the bigger picture that gave rise to the foreground. So let's not lose sight of the bigger picture of it all. And what's the beginning of a solution? Of course, part of this is having the conversations we are all already having, deeply appreciated, and I want to be part of it somehow, so here I am. But also again, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, today we are celebrating his day, and what best way of celebrating him than embracing his teaching? So let us submit perfectly to the truth, more and more. Let's have no sympathy for untruth, starting with us in our own being, not hear about finding enemies outside. Start at home, starting with our own blind spots, prejudices, defense mechanisms, our own institutional anxieties, our own labeling of things, people putting things into boxes, fixed ideas about things that need update, refinement, and in some cases even death, to be born again. So again, no need for scapegoating, no need for mob mentality, no need for demonizing, just need for honesty and courage and willingness to let whatever is unhealthy or outdated dissolve, so what is essential can remain, can deepen, can be reborn, can continue to evolve and grow. And again, needless to say, not everyone will be ready to embrace such a view, this perspective. So also, there's a need to normalize that. as part of the journey. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur once said, in his own words, speaking about Kanishtha and a Madhyam, or a more beginner's mind person, a little bit more narrow-minded, fanatical, immature, and a more dynamic, open-minded person. He said, there will be always conflict between Kanishtha's and Madhyam mentality. Always. Mm-hmm. The Madhyam may understand why the Kanishtha is thinking as he's thinking. Maybe the Kanishtha is not able to understand the Madhyam yet. It's part of the journey. It's unavoidable. Not to fall into fatalism, pessimism, cynicism, just mature acknowledgement of how reality operates. And remember, institutional failure doesn't equal spiritual failure. And therefore, if you are inside of ISKCON, whatever it means to be inside of ISKCON, may you find the strength to seek truth without fear. Knowing that the price, again, for betraying yourself is always higher and greater than the price to embrace truth, no matter the consequences. And if you're outside of ISKCON, again, whatever that means, may you do exactly the same. Independently of this particular situation, may you walk your talk and live your life with authenticity and integrity. Because at the end of the day, again, this particular issue I'm pointing today, we are talking about these days, is a microcosm of the greater macrocosm of how we are choosing to live our life at every day, at every step for eternity. As a teacher of mine once told me, how you do anything is how you do everything. So how we react to any given specific circumstance, speaking about how we are dealing with the greater totality of reality as a whole. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your honest participation in this conversation. Thank you for listening. Let's keep the conversation ongoing. Again, not as a war, but hopefully as a sacred pilgrimage, sacred exploration. And let's treat each other again with understanding, with compassion, while courageously pursuing the highest truth as we can perceive it according to our present capacity in this fearless spirit that Abhayita Naravindam Bhaktivedanta Swami embodied, in the fearless spirit that Srila Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur embodied, whose appearance day we are celebrating today. Here one small footnote to make an important point, and I somehow forgot to emphasize enough or even mention in the context of mentioning so many other topics, which is the importance to grieve loss, to grieve whatever may die, may collapse, whether it is, again, a version of ourselves, a version of an institution, but let's stand to grief in a healthy way, in the context of love. That's an expression of love, and that's a very healing and necessary chapter of our journey, and we may need to stay there as much as we need to stay there. And many times, as I would like to say, the duty of an entire generation many times is to grieve the ungrieved grief of their ancestors or previous generation. What to speak of the things we need to grieve that come from our own lives. So in the context of the main topic of today's presentation, I think I want just to record separately this footnote. How all this invites us also for collective and individual grief, not just saying, okay, something may need to be to die as part of the cycle of progress and evolution. Yes, normalizing that, accepting that, but in the context, part of accepting and normalizing that is spending enough time to grieve. We only grieve about the things we love. So something has died, something has disappeared, something is no longer there. We love that. We grieve about it, and that will prepare our hearts to be ready for the new version of it, to embrace it for the new version of ourselves. So, a note of grief to conclude this particular presentation.